Hello, everyone, and welcome to Risky Business episode 400. Oh my God, where does the time go? My name, of course, is Patrick Gray, and we've got a great show for you this week with big thanks to this week's sponsor, Sanitas. On this week's podcast, we'll be chatting about the week's security news with Adam Boileau. Obviously, that will feature a lot of chat about Apple versus FBI. We'll also hear from Daniel Hodson of Eltham Security here in Australia. Daniel and his business partner, Matt Jones, have been looking into the security of messaging software that has been recommended by the EFF. Does a bunch of ticks from the EFF actually say much about app security? Well, as you'll hear, not really. Stay tuned for that. In this week's sponsor interview, we hear from Sanitas co-founder and CTO Julian Fay. Sanitas, of course, make Layer 2 encryption equipment, and they will be releasing a 100 gigabits per second full line speed encryption box soon. Full line rate, 100 gig. They make awesome kit. But yeah, this week, Julian joins us to weigh in briefly on the Apple versus FBI mess, as well as to have a discussion about some interesting use cases he's seen for Layer 2 stuff recently. All of that is coming up later, but first, as always, it's time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend, Adam Boileau. So, Adam, obviously we're going to start this week's show with the last week of developments in the FBIOS. Oh, the FBIOS scandal. And it looks like all sides want this to go before Congress for some sort of resolution. That's the FBI. Apple wants this. Bill Gates, who initially was like, well, I'm kind of on the FBI's side. And then he's like, well, no, I'm not. And now he's like, well, just let Congress deal with it. So it looks where that's heading. And I'm not at all surprised.
No, I mean, clearly it's a pretty big problem and a big pickle that everyone's got themselves into. And I mean, the courts probably aren't immediately equipped to decide, because I mean, it does go in directions that, you know, are going to require, you know, very high level political consideration. I mean, certainly, you know, one of the angles being pushed is that, you know, maybe this is free speech. And at that point, it starts to get very rah-rah.
Code is free speech as protected by the, you know, the amendment to the US Constitution, etc. I thought that was cute.
Yeah, well, and I mean, you can kind of see the point that they're trying to make, but yeah, it's, you know,
well,
it's
that kind of invalidates the Vassanar arrangement, so there's, you know, that could cause problems.
Yes, yeah. I mean, obviously, a lot of things interact poorly with Vassanar, so yeah. You know, this is just on one of the many on the list there. But no, it's you know, it's a story that's really blown up into you know, a very complicated mess of, you know, quite specific technical details, you know, right down to whether the FBI could reasonably expect to, you know, decap the chip with acid.
Well, and, you know, actually, let me just cut you off there, because there's one guy I know who, you know, there's the people who say but don't know, and the people who know but can't say. I've spoken to one of the people who can't really say recently, and they've told me that it would be very easy, especially with a 5C, to remove one of the NAND chips, put a jailbreak onto the unencrypted portion of one of these NAND chips, and then put it back on the device, and it would be jailbroken. It is absolutely piss easy. They can do it in 5 minutes with a heat gun.
Yeah, no, that's a sneaky and sounds like an entirely reasonable approach. Mm. And one wonders why you wouldn't do that if you had the option.
Well, because you want to bring this to a head, right?
Exactly. And that's the thing, is that all of the sides involved really want this, you know, taken to a place where everyone actually knows what's happening, rather than being stuck in the middle where we are.
Well, that's right. And Apple is even free under this court order to choose an alternative unlocking device. So it's not like, you know, they really do want this brought to a head. And I just wonder that I wonder if they've drawn the line in the wrong place, because it's very obvious from seeing all of the letters that they have published that this is all of their pre-written, pre-organized strategy for the crypto wars, when we were getting towards that backdooring phase, right? If Congress was going to put legislation in saying, you know, you can't actually secure your devices against these sort of attacks, this was the rhetoric they were going to roll. So they've been running a political campaign from word dot. So it's no surprise now they're agitating to get this in front of Congress. But I just think, well, maybe you guys should make some changes to your secure enclave first so that these attacks can't work. And then you should dig in, because my fear is now that they've drawn this line a little bit prematurely, it'll go to Congress. Congress will say, well, actually, no, we're just going to make sure that the FBI can use these sorts of tools, and you can't stop them from, you know, and you can't make engineering changes to invalidate these tools.
Yeah, and that's quite an interesting point there, that they have maybe started this a little too early. I mean, certainly the picking on something that is specific around a 5C and where they are talking about providing mechanisms to allow the FBI to brute force versus, as you say, coming up with something like where the current secure enclave tech is heading, where it would actually just be plain and feasible for them to do anything. And if they'd already sold products like that and then Congress kind of retroactively tell them to do it, that would be kind of a different sort of thing than right now, where, some people, as you say, are quite legitimately saying that, that they could deliver this particular case without it actually being, a significant backdoor of the kind of risk that they're describing. So, yeah.
Well, and I'm sick of Apple calling it a backdoor, right? Because they're not being asked to create a backdoor. They're being asked to create a key for the backdoor that Apple accidentally left in there.
Right? Well, yeah. I mean, they're asking to, disable some of the software controls that make it not feasible to brute force the PIN, which, as you say, is a bit different to a backdoor. And, yeah, I think, this debate would have been better had Apple fielded a system where that wasn't an option, which is kind of the case with the 6s to a greater extent than the 5C.
Not from what I've discovered by talking to people. Like, you can absolutely do the same thing to Apple's, 5S and above secure enclave devices. Like, that's not an issue at all.
Yeah, but I mean, I think we're heading towards the point where it would actually be a problem. They had waited until then things would be a little bit easier. But I suppose in the big picture, if that goes to Congress and Congress says you must make your devices interceptable and man-in-the-middleable or backdoorable or whatever, ridiculous thing they come up with, then what, right? Are we going to say if the Americans do it that everybody else can? I mean, I'm sure the Chinese would love to have this capability against Apple phones. Because, I mean, this is really a triumph, right? The fact that we've got a piece of technology that is sufficiently secure that you have to actually go and argue about getting access to it rather than just doing them. That's a success, right? I mean, it's amazing that we are here.
I did an interview yesterday on ABC Radio, and I said, there's a long-standing saying in information security, which is physical access always wins. And that's been invalidated only very, very recently, right? So, yeah, you're right. It is a victory that we've got this far. And look, I really understand why the FBI have dug in on this one, because you're talking about a dead terrorist who actually, carried out an attack on American soil. Like, you're talking about a state-owned device where the employer has given permission, for the FBI to access data on there. So they've got a nice clear run at it, really unsympathetic, person's phone. What I don't understand is why Apple chose to dig in on this one. I just don't get it. I think it's a cataclysmic up from a political perspective, and I think it's going to backfire on them big time. And that's why I've been critical of them. It's not that I think that the USA should be able to tell Apple what to do in all circumstances. It's just you pick your battles. This is the wrong battle for Apple.
Yeah, it's hard to disagree with your analysis there, I think. Hey? Like, they could have picked them better. This is not the, if they had quietly rolled this one and just kind of added it to the pile of things that they've already got. I mean, that's one of the things that's come out, I guess, in the last week, is that Apple have, produced a list. Here's all the previous cases where we've been asked, that we are currently being asked to do this. So it's not just an isolated case. And they could have just added this to that list, I suppose, and then picked a smarter battle a little bit further in the future.
Well, they could have said, we've been asked to create an unlocking utility for a phone that belonged to a guy who killed 14 Americans in California, yada, yada, yada. We've been ordered by the courts to do this. We are going to engineer our product so that these orders will not be successful in the future.
Yeah, and that might have been an easier battle to fight, but yeah, it's not the one they've picked.
Well, and they are worried about precedent, but it seems like, and I'm not a lawyer, but they seem to be hyping this idea that if they agree to create this utility, then, okay, they will have to create it for other cases. And I can certainly see that that is an argument they can make. But then they're saying, oh, well, what's to stop them using the All Writs Act to force us to push signed malicious updates to users? I'm like, well, isn't that an entirely different thing? You would think there would need to be another order issued by the court for that to happen, right? And the FBI, rhetorically, is running rings around Apple as well. I mean, Apple is certainly losing the public battle with this one, which is entirely predictable. I mean, a dead terrorist's phone. James Comey even wrote a piece in which he sounded entirely reasonable, right? So this is another thing that makes me think tactically Apple have screwed up. I mean, did you see James Comey's piece? I mean, I'm sure he's being disingenuous in parts, but it's a very sellable message, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is. Like he, you know, the rhetoric and the, you know, sort of the use of language and making it, you know, personal about the victims and all that kind of thing is, you know, it's a good spin. And then he comes, you know, comes across very clearly saying this is about one particular example. It's not about setting a precedent. It's not about getting a tool that we can use elsewhere. It's one case of, you know, helping a bunch of victims, you know, families who've lost people, you know, to understand what happened, which, you know, that's a...
And there's been a poll. There's been a poll. Apple is clearly losing, okay? 51% of people surveyed said Apple should unlock the device. I think something in the mid-30s or high 30s said they shouldn't, with the rest undecided. But, you know, certainly when we look at across the general population, I'm not talking about the technology sector where Apple is clearly, you know, winning the hearts and minds, but where it really matters, which is out there everywhere in America, the FBI is winning.
Yeah, although on the other hand, so is Trump. So, you know.
Yeah, well.
How much stock do we put in their opinions?
Well, they're the guys who run the show, ultimately, right? So yeah, this has become a political issue. And ultimately, you know, and this is why Apple pulled the trigger on all of that rhetoric, right? Because they knew, they understood very quickly that this was about winning hearts and minds. And that's where Congress people take their guidance from, is polling, right? So let's just see how that all goes. But we should move on to some other stories now. And Linux Mint has been owned, trojaned, you know, owned sideways in every possible way.
Yeah, it looks like someone popped the WordPress site that runs their, you know, front-end web server and forums and blogs and stuff, and posted a link to a Trojan Linux Mint ISO file and updated the signatures and stuff on the web page for a while. And yes, of course, a bunch of people downloaded it. It didn't appear to be a particularly high-quality Trojaning, but yeah, nevertheless, not a good look for Linux Mint, which, I mean, I guess already didn't have the world's greatest supply chain. There and then some other, you know, subsequent to that, it looks like maybe their forums were also popped in the process, or at least the database behind the forums was popped. And yeah, it's just not looking particularly well. The Linux Mint guys have responded and taken their site down and have up, you know, released an update which you know, will attempt to figure out if you have in fact installed the bad version. But on the other hand, do you really want to install an update from Linux Mint right about now? I don't think so.
So yeah, bad week there all around. Asus, meanwhile, they've been dinged by the FTC for, you know, like making really shit routers. And yeah, but I mean, the write-ups around this are really saying that this is putting, you know, IoT manufacturers on notice that the US government will actually take action. Now, I got to say, it's unusual to want to really support government meddling in these sorts of things, but it seems like they've done us a solid by going after Asus like this.
Absolutely right. If we think Linux Mint's having a bad week, Asus is going to have a bad 20 years because the FTC, the settlement they reached with the FTC requires them to have 6 monthly audits of all of their devices for the next 20 years.
Yep.
And they're not allowed to say that they're secure on the packaging because they're not. And their secure, you know, file cloud thingy that they were selling with their routers, also not allowed to say it's secure because it's not. So, yes, this is, you know, really the only hope I think we're going to see, you know, for having consumer-level devices that have no margin in them to pay for security and, you know, are never going to get updated and, you know, just bad from a lifecycle point of view, bad from an installation point of view, just bad full stop. This is the only way that these vendors are going to listen, because I mean, clearly consumers can't make good choices when they buy them because they all say they're secure and none of them are. Whereas, you know, at least now Asus will say we're not secure and everyone else will say they're secure, and then that'll somehow improve things. But no,
less carrot, more stick, right? Awesome.
Yes. And there is, you know, certainly, you know, 20-year settlements in the internet era. That's it's quite beautiful, really.
That's an internet eternity, really. Hunt has actually written up a really awesome blog post, which, you know, relates to this in that Nissan have done some wonderfully secure things with their electric car, the Leaf. Adam.
So Troy was teaching a class in Norway or something about how to hack stuff, and one of his students went home, you know, after day one of the class and got man in the middle between his phone and his car. He has a Nissan Leaf electric car and has a corresponding like iOS app that you can use to get stats about the car and, you know, turn the heating on and all that kind of thing. Gets in the middle with his proxy. And sure enough, there is no auth at all whatsoever. You just have the serial number of the car that you'd like to talk to, and that's entirely it. So Troy's been talking through the process of telling Nissan about this, and turns out that actually there are a bunch of people already knew, and there were people on the forums on the internet, you know, already talking to other people's leaves and presumably turning their heating on and off. But I wish I could say that I was surprised. You know, it's an Internet of Things device. It just happens to be in a car, you know, always connected to the to the cell network. And yes, no auth whatsoever. And
well, let's hope the FTC rubs their nose in their, you know, digital doo-doo here, did with Asus. Bad Nissan. Audits for you for the next 20 years.
You know, if they didn't learn their lesson from watching how it went for, Chrysler and, you know, being Charlie Millard, then... Maybe they would learn from the FTC. Maybe they would.
There we go. So you can go hack your Leaf if you'd like to. A bloke who has been charged with basically doing some spearfishing attacks against celebrities to steal nude images from their iCloud and their Gmail accounts. He's been dinged for possession, you know, for obtaining 161 nude images. Up for sentencing soon, facing a potential 5 years. His name is Andrew Helton, 29, of Portland. And we're not really sure if he's part of that crew who released a whole bunch of images as part of the so-called fappening.
Yeah, no, we're not sure, although obviously the rest of the facts do kind of line up, even though there's no direct attribution. But yeah, facing sentencing for 5 years, we will find out during the second what he actually gets.
This is great. You know, Komodo, maker of fine security software. You know, Tavis Ormondy's been ripping them to bits for a while. But it turns out they had like a VNC server listening on localhost for some reason. I've got no idea why. But, you know, obviously that was a problem because sandboxed apps like Chrome and whatever could connect to it. And then, you know, that's a real nice way of jumping out of the sandbox. And Komodo's way to fix this was by putting a password on it, which you would think would be great, but then they derived the password from stuff that's like trivially available to any sandbox process. And, you know, it's that sort of story.
Yeah, Tavis Ormondy versus the AV industry, you know, round 437, knockout in the first 3 seconds to Tavis. Next round, same again, and on we go. So, yeah, Komodo claim they're going to fix it, but really they're not going to fix it, are they? They're just going to be doing something else wrong somewhere else, just like all the rest of the AV
vendors.
Don't
use Komodo. Moral of the story, don't use Komodo. Here's BBC News is reporting a mystery spike in hidden service addresses, which is most likely the result of some malware out there or someone, you know, doing something a bit funky or doing some sort of experiment or something. But there's been an increase of tens of thousands of .onion addresses. But this BBC story says it might actually be my buddy John Brooks with Ricochet because, you know, as we said last week, Ricochet passed its – well, you know, passed is probably the wrong word. Ricochet received a favourable security audit. Got some headlines, and even the BBC is speculating it might be us.
Yeah, but that's certainly nice. A little bit of publicity, but yeah, no, realistically,
it's bullshit. But you know, it's great to get us in the news.
Yeah, I mean, you know, all of the crypto locker Trojans that are running around at the moment, probably someone's, you know, running those across Onion Network addresses, which would explain the, you know, rise in number of addresses and not the amount of traffic corresponding. But yes, it's great to see Ricochet on the BBC, and I'm sure maybe there will, in fact, now be a spike in users.
So yeah, well, that's the thing, you know. Now, you know, IRS fraud in the United States has been, an increasingly horror show issue for the US government. But, you know, this 400% surge in tax-related phishing is going to turn this year's tax season in the United States into an absolute disaster, according to ThreatPost.
Yeah, no, it really does look like they're gearing up for a bit of a bloodbath there, and we're seeing, you know, the full range of modern attack classes being deployed against this.
Yeah, there's all different crews deploying all different attacks. It's crazy, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, phishing attacks. There's one example which is, you know, spoofed emails, you know, to the HR department saying, please, can you send me a copy of all of the tax return forms for all of the employees, you know, from the CFO or something. With, you know, seeing the usual sorts of malware and keyloggers and drive-bys and watering holes and everything. But yeah, it's really going to be a bloodbath, especially when you consider that the advice people are being given is that the only thing you can do is really file your tax return earlier than the attacker. Like, if that's what we've come down to, it's really not going to go well for you.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, this is coming up soon because they file in April. That's the cutoff time in the United States. We're used to the crypto locker people targeting WordPress sites to try to distribute their malware. It looks like they've added some Joomla exploits to their kits and they're now targeting Joomla.
Yeah, the people who are running the relatively large ad media campaign where they were, you know, owning WordPress sites and dropping JavaScript in that would then hit you with CryptoLocker Trojans have moved on to apparently owning Joomla sites. It's not entirely clear which set of Joomla bugs they're using. Obviously, they have plenty of options. But yeah, they're using the same payloads and the same end goal of delivering ransomware through that mechanism.
Also from Wired, this is a great story, actually. You know how everyone's saying, oh, no, it wasn't North Korea who was behind the Sony hack. You know, it was all, you know, disgruntled ex-employees, whatever. Well, that's what Norse said to get headlines, because that's all Norse really was interested in doing in that case. But, you know, there were a lot of people who were saying it was a conspiracy and whatever, and they were just pinning it on North Korea. Well, there's some new research out now, which is just showing the background of this crew who took down Sony. And it was, yeah, it was mostly doing things like targeting South Korean websites. Which tends to suggest that the North Korean attribution may have in fact been accurate.
Yeah, no, this is a really good, a very detailed, you know, write-up and investigation with a, you know, sort of combined team from Symantec and Kaspersky and Alien Vault and Nevada that have published this write-up. And they pulled together a whole bunch of technical artifacts of the people who hit Sony and then, you know, back through time, you know, to about 2007. And I mean, if you, you know, you're reading between the lines, there is no direct attribution to North Korea, but certainly the nature of the targets, the nature of their attacks, the modus operandi that, you know, tied together the, I mean, like the way that they, in the Sony hack where they used, you know, what was it, the Guardians of Peace, some rubbish, you know, hacker crew that they invented and then threw away, like that kind of style showing up in a bunch of the previous things they've done. Like, it's a pretty, you know, pretty compelling sort of a collection of data that does point towards it being, you know, state-sponsored or state-funded.
Well,
North
and
Korean.
Them hitting the US and South Korea with massive DDoS attacks over the 4th of July holiday weekend in 2009. I mean, you know, it does tend to suggest that. It's these researchers are calling them the Lazarus Group, but it's just yet another data point that suggests that that attribution was accurate.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there isn't a smoking gun, but you can't read that report and not come away with the conclusion that it's the North Koreans, in my opinion.
Oh, now this is one that I just wanted to mention very quickly. Wired has a write-up of some research by Bastille, which, you know, shock horror, quell surprise. Turns out, you know, non-Bluetooth and non-Wi-Fi wireless keyboards and mice aren't in fact that secure. But the reason this research is useful is because they've actually got a list of affected manufacturers. And, you know, for certain enterprises, they might just want to take a look around and make sure none of this is in their building.
Yeah, no, it is. It's a good write-up. And there's a couple of technical tricks that they've pulled, which are a little bit different than some of the previous ones. Like, for example, spoofing. I mean, often with the wireless mouse and keyboard combos, the keyboards are encrypted and the mice aren't, because, I mean, mouse data is not particularly sensitive. But you can send keyboard data packets from the mouse, like pretending to be the mouse without crypto, and then use that to inject keystrokes. And that's novel. But yeah, they've got a list of devices and talked to a bunch of the vendors. Some of the vendor responses are complete rubbish, as you know, I guess no one's surprised particularly. But yeah, certainly Microsoft, Dell, Logitech are a few of the, Lenovo are a few of the affected things. Anything that really uses the low-cost radios from Nordic and where the firmware written by the vendors is not great, which, you know, unsurprisingly is all of them. So yeah, certainly anywhere you're deploying that in your organizations, you'd probably want to think about, and especially because of the kind of range they're talking about is in, you know, hundreds of meters that they're demonstrating, which, you know, outside the building, that's, you know, that is a real attack.
Moving on to our last couple of technical items, a rogue iOS app has been booted out of the Chinese iTunes App Store. It allowed people who were using non-jailbroken iOS devices to use jailbroken apps. I don't know how that works, but interesting that an app like that can exist, and also interesting that it could get into the App Store. So there's that. And also a you know, the Angler exploit kit, which is, you know, the biggest and baddest of the lot, has just added a bunch of new Silverlight exploits, which kind of surprised me because I didn't think anyone was using Silverlight anymore.
well, yes, it's not exactly, you know, burgeoning in market share, but in this particular case, this exploit is interesting because it does appear to be begat from the guy who was selling Silverlight exploits to Hacking Team. It has some similarities in terms of the actual exploit code itself. So yeah, it looks like that particular guy may still be in business and selling to the Angular crew instead.
Well, yeah, I guess when his client sort of, I don't know, what's happened to Hacking Team anyway? Are they still around?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. I haven't heard anything. They've either gone underground successfully or they've imploded. Who knows?
Who knows? Okay, Adam, that is actually it for the week's news. Thank you very much for joining us on our 400th episode, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, congrats, Pat. That's a hell of an episode count. I'll talk to you next week.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news headlines. Thanks, Adam. Now, before we continue, I just want to say a big thanks to everyone who participated in the Risky Business Listener Survey. I got over 650 responses, which honestly, it really blew me away because, you know, all of that information is super useful. I was not expecting such a big response. I've now got a mate helping me out with sales in the USA, and he's going to be able to dazzle the marketroids over there with amazing amazing figures and stats. So yeah, thanks everyone. Really do appreciate you actually taking the time to fill that out. It's insanely helpful. And the stats that sort of came out of it are very helpful because, as it turns out, you know, the audience that listens to this show is the type of audience that most sponsors and advertisers want. So that was also a nice surprise. Okay, moving on. And it is time for this week's feature interview now with Daniel Hodson, who's sometimes known by his handle, Mercy. He's a familiar face here in Australia, and he's been doing some interesting stuff lately with his business partner, Matt Jones, another familiar face in Australia. Now, these guys have a relatively new app security assessment company named Altum Security, and they thought it'd be fun to take a crack at owning some of these chat apps that have been named by the EFF as awesome on their secure messaging scorecard. The idea is they give each of the more popular apps on the list — this is Altum, not EFF — Altum will give each of the more popular apps on the list 24 hours of audit time and see if any awful bugs shake out. Now, I 100% get why they're doing this. Through the work that I've done on Invisible IM and the Ricochet project, I've come to understand that the way people think about messaging security generally is actually pretty backwards. People seem much more interested in security features and claims and checkbox items than things like code quality, which just seems quite backwards. Now, Ricochet, as regular listeners would know, did okay in its audit, but despite that, I'd hate to see it written up by the EFF as being an awesome solution with a bunch of green ticks next to it, because frankly, one audit, even though we did well, it doesn't really tell you something is free of bugs. And even audits that don't turn up horrible bugs can turn up awful coding practices. So in particular, the EFF has a checkbox for has something been audited, and it doesn't really say whether or not it did well in the audit. It's just a green tick. So these green ticks by the EFF, I feel, are giving users a level of assurance that, you know, just kind of isn't justified. And Daniel and Matt feel the same way, which is why they're diving into these 24-hour audits. I get it. And I hope they'll do their best to shred Ricochet as well when they're done with some of the others on their target list. But anyway, I thought it would be awesome to hear directly from Daniel about why he and Matt are doing this and what they found out. Here's Daniel Hodson.
You know, Matt and I were sort of hacking over a weekend, and he'd done sort of security code reviews over IM products before, but the EFF secure messaging scorecard was sort of on our radar at that time, just because, you know, privacy is sort of coming one of those hot topics. And, you know,
becoming,
we were sort of curious.
Jesus, man, where have you been?
Well, you know, everyone's sort of wanting to find this nice, easy to use solution, and EFF scorecard is sort of presented there for, you know, just public consumption. You know, you don't need to be a tech whiz to be able to use it.
Yeah, you just look for the maximum number of ticks and away you go.
Exactly. So for us, we sort of had a quick look over, you know, who's got ticks and who's got the crosses. And it was almost funny, you know, when you sort of see things there like Pigeon for Windows, you know, has a lot of ticks against it. And just given its security track record alone is enough to question, you know, well, what does it really take to be an app on this kind of list?
Because it really is about features, isn't it? Not about code quality at all. It seems like, you know, maybe an audit gets a tick, but beyond that, code quality isn't really considered.
Pretty much. And, you know, that sort of idea was kind of reflected also, you know, I saw like a Hacker News article where other people in the security community were sort of mentioning like the concerns around something like, has there been a recent code audit? You know, what does that actually mean? You know, something's got a green tick next to it, but does that mean that it passed with flying colors and there's nothing wrong? Or, you know,
does that mean
really
that their audit report had read all over it and said, oh my God, these guys don't know what they're doing and their coding quality is terrible and they follow bad practices, etc.?
Exactly. So sort of our idea here was to just pick a subset of the applications from the list, preferably those which pretty much get all ticks, and to sort of see like, okay, you know, you're sort of recommending that people use it, but in reality, you know, what are the risks? You know, how in depth was their evaluation to sort of come to that conclusion that it's something that which people should download and use to protect their communications?
So I like it. You picked — the first one that you picked was called RetroShare, and it gets a tick because it's encrypted in transit, encrypted so the provider can't read it. You can verify contact identities. Past communications are protected if your keys are stolen. You know, is the code open to independent review? Tick. Is security design properly documented? Tick. And then, of course, the last one, has there been a recent code audit? There's a big fat red, you know, slash through that. So, I mean, that was the one that you went to, obviously, because you're like, well, it's a lot of green ticks, no audit. Let's actually dive into it. And you did find some stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So for this, you know, the list itself, and there's a lot of IAM applications on there. So we're kind of like, well, we can't spend, you know, months on every single application. So let's kind of constrain ourselves to like maybe a day's worth of work, you know, 24 hours to really see what the code quality is like. And maybe we can sort of extrapolate that to form a like a general opinion, you know, do we think it is secure or not? So in the case of RetroShare, you know, we kind of downloaded that, started to have a look through it, and then, you know, instantly what starts popping out is, you know, a bunch of these sort of what you'd call like insecure coding practice issues. You know, generally, you know, they can be turned into full-blown vulnerabilities, but there's just so many of them that we were kind of like, well, you know, already we can see that this code doesn't really meet the bar. So let's see how much further we can take this. You know, can we find proper remote code executions in this? Can we actually start triggering vulnerabilities in such a short amount of time? And to us, that's sort of really showing the weakness of this scorecard.
You shouldn't be able to pop shell within 24 hours, right? I mean, that's yeah, a pretty exactly. good rule of thumb.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially when it's being held up as something secure. Hey, you know, one thing that actually surprises me is I know someone who was involved in auditing LibOTR. You know, LibOTR is actually pretty good now. Shock horror.
Yeah, it's sort of, you know, I'd seen posts around that, and it's actually something which we're considering to look at next is like a combined Pigeon plus OTR and sort of see that. I think Hawks actually, like Ben Hawks, had something to say on the whole LibOTR.
He's always been doing mean things to LibOTR though. Yeah. But I think, no, the most recent analysis of LibOTR actually says, hey, it's pretty good. They've actually reached the bottom of the vulnerability pit on that one, which is nice.
Absolutely. And I actually think that's something which really needs to kind of find its way into this kind of scorecard, right? Is the ability to say, you know, we've done so many audits, we've sort of noticed that this sort of trend or the vulnerability trend is becoming less, and it's really getting difficult for people to find bugs there. And I think once you get to that sort of stage, then yeah, maybe it does deserve a green tick, but you know, otherwise, sort of got no place being on there.
It is funny though, isn't it, that the EFF have actually created this scorecard, and a lot of it is about, you know, basic encryption features, and code quality seems to be like almost like an afterthought. It is actually the last tick, right? So how much do you think that is focusing on the wrong things as far as where their scorecard focuses?
Yeah, I mean, those two things don't really deserve to be in the same sentence, right? Like, you can't have privacy without good code quality that backs it up, right? So our real emphasis is to try and say, like, hey, look, you know, privacy is fantastic, but it needs to have a real strong foundation that it's built upon. So, you know, when you've got like five or six of the checkboxes just to do with, like, is it encrypted or not?
Are they using perfect forward secrecy? Yeah. And then there's trivial buffer overflows all up in it, and, you know, it's compiled with the wrong settings and, yeah.
Exactly. Because this is something which is kind of often overlooked, right, is like this thing where privacy and security, you sort of mention it in the same breath, but they're almost two different things. You know, you need security to support privacy. And so you can't really just focus on the encryption side of things if the code quality sucks.
So what are you going to look at next? Because, you know, you've done RetroShare, as I said, and it didn't exactly come up tops. Are you going to look at some of the ones that, you know, that do actually have the green tick for recent code audits? Because that's where I'm interested in. Because, you know, it's become such a thing among people who aren't in security to go, oh, yeah, it's had a code audit. It's sweet, you know. But it's like, how long ago was it? Who was doing it? These things make a big difference, right?
Absolutely. So I think the next one is definitely going to be with all green ticks. We kind of want to keep this fun for ourselves as well. So I think we're going to take a stab at the OTR messaging for Windows using Pigeon.
Yeah, I noticed that. That's the one that sticks out to me too. I'm like, if I had to pick one of these to shred, it's not going to be Signal or Redphone. Do you know what I mean? It's going to be OTR and Pigeon.
Plus, I mean, I sort of, you know, I've got faith in the old Azimuth security. So, you know, they've already taken a stab at like the whole black phone and silent text, and they found awesome bugs in that as well, right? So I think it's really, you know, for a security community, I don't see why we shouldn't just take a stab at pretty much everything. And what we get out of it is just improved IAM applications and these privacy features. You know, it kind of helps everyone.
How would you like to see the EFF modify the scorecard?
Sure. So one thing which kind of popped out to me was there was a lack of sort of transparency or evidence which backs up some of these sort of ticks in the matrix. For one, you know, you're talking about, you know, can you verify contact identities? Is it encrypted or yada, yada? It would be fantastic if they can actually start pointing to things like the documentation and the configuration, you know, how... You know,
yeah, what do you mean by verify contact identities? Does that mean that they've got something that is signed by a CA or like, what, you know, how are you verifying?
Exactly. And I guess the other thing is there's sort of this implicit trust in their scorecard where they ask the developers the questions and they base it on the responses, you know, oh, yeah, sure, you know, we've had a code audit, but we're not going to supply you with the results. And they kind of take that as like, okay, sure, you've had the code audit done. And I think for privacy, you know, it really needs to be open for independent review and for people to really see what the results are, you know, to validate it for themselves, more or less.
Now, quite often with things like this, there is a real focus on RCE, right? Everyone loves to pop shell, but you've found that quite often the bugs that affect these types of, you know, this type of software are often silly things like cross-site scripting and whatnot, but they could be quite serious because they can lead to credential exposure, they can lead to de-anonymization, all sorts of things. You are seeing those types of bugs, aren't you, more commonly in messenger-type software?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, one of the things with privacy-based communication is it needs to remain private. And it's really interesting to sort of look over some other reviews done from other people and sort of see what sort of results they're getting. And like there's a great one from Exodus Intelligence where they're looking at the Tails distro. And they found sort of XSS type issues which would allow you to de-anonymize the traffic. And in our own case, looking at the RetroShare, you know, we had both memory corruptions, but there was also a lot of vulnerabilities up higher in the stack, you know, things like XSRF and so on, which similarly allow you to bypass that sort of privacy-focused, you know, encrypted communication channel anyway. And just to sort of even go one step further, you know, you've even got attacks like the Heartbleed, where it's not always about popping the shell.
It might be about key disclosure or memory leakage, things like that.
Exactly, yeah. So you can sort of get some really interesting information without always needing to pop the shell. So that's why I think, you know, with these sorts of applications, it actually needs a really strong foundation because what might not be too interesting in other types of applications, if you have like remote memory disclosure, it's kind of game over for this stuff.
Yeah, well, we discovered this with the HTML rendering contact request bug in Ricochet, right? So, yeah. Definitely feeling you on that one. Now, one thing that you have mentioned is that RetroShare were pretty good once you got in touch with them and highlighted some issues, right?
Yeah, they were fantastic, actually. So we sort of time-constrained ourselves, but we had no real sort of requirements on the other end. You know, we sort of figured we'll give them roughly 90-day disclosure timeline.
So you weren't being like full disk jerks, basically, is what you're saying there.
trying not to. And but it was really nice to see. So they actually got all the patches out and fixed it all up within about 24 hours. And they sort of went one step further. You know, they were really keen on having sort of this sort of continuous code reviews and security attention paid towards their project. And it sort of got us thinking like, well, that's definitely something these sorts of scorecards or anything where you're an authority, you should definitely start promoting, you know, please, you know, take a look at it. They're more than happy to receive these sorts of submissions, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, trying to get people to do what you did for them, and I'm speaking from experience here, it's very difficult to get people with your sort of skills to go and use their free time to hack stuff. So generally, you know, I imagine the among these sorts of products, if you want to call them that, or projects where security is an aim, like it's pretty much a dream come true when some guy comes along and drops a bunch of bugs on you. You're just like, thank you so much.
Absolutely. And I mean, my logic is, you know, they're open source and they're sort of doing their part to sort of help out the community at large. So we may as well, you know, try and contribute back.
Yeah, well, I look forward to you guys turning up some stuff in Ricochet. So again, please, please hack that software. But Daniel Hodson, it's been very interesting talking to you about your initial toying around with software on the EFF messaging scorecard. And I very much look forward to seeing what else you guys come up with.
Great. Thanks very much.
Daniel Mercy Hodson there with a chat about his work on some spare time code audits of messaging products the EFF says are awesome. And I've dropped a link into this week's show notes to their blog where you can read about the first one they've done, and I'm sure they'll be updating that with more information in the future. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Julian Fay of Senatas Security, an Australian company, a publicly listed Australian company that makes really awesome Layer 2 encryption gear. Julian joined me via Skype to talk about the Apple fiasco, some interesting use cases for Layer 2 crypto gear, and to get the skinny on when Senatas will be dropping its 100 gig full line rate crypto box. That is coming soon. Now, I should point out that Julian has just come back to Australia from Europe, and he is very, very unwell at the moment. He's picked up some sort of awful bug that has seen him shiver and sweat his way through the last couple of days. He's home very crook. So what can I say? I'm stoked that he could still join us. Thank you, Julian. You are a genuine trooper. He joined me via Skype for this interview, and I started off by asking him if a recent New York Times article that said Apple could quite effectively lock the FBI out of future physical access attacks was accurate. And here's what he had to say.
Yeah, it's definitely feasible. I mean, they've got the secure enclave chip in the current generation of products. And I believe were that to be configured appropriately, which it doesn't seem to be at the moment, then they could basically build a mechanism that would keep themselves completely locked out. So that's a completely separate processor. It's a separate CPU within the hardware. It runs its own software that's walled off from the rest of the system. So it's a completely outside the control of the main OS, including the kernel. So that can do passcode verification, does the touch ID recognition, etc., etc. Now, I believe that in the current iPhone 5S onwards, it is still possible to subvert that secure enclave, but you have to do a couple of firmware updates, is my understanding.
Yeah. No, I mean, you can overwrite certain bits without overriding the content encryption keys and whatnot. So you can pretty much do what the FBI is asking to any iPhone, but yeah, I'm getting conflicting reports about how easy it would be to actually just make it so that you couldn't do this again in the future.
Well, I mean, that's a separate processor. If that were, for example, to be a read-only operating system that was basically hard-coded to and completely unprogrammable in the future, then they could put up whatever kind of protection they want, I imagine, to isolate it from the main OS and force you to enter passcodes, keys, etc., to extract the information from it. So I think it's a matter of how they choose to implement the firmware inside that. At the moment, I believe they make it's actually upgradable itself.
Well, that's because if there's a change to Apple Pay or something, they need to be able to, you know, zap that out.
Yeah. So that's going to be the trade-off for them. But I think from a pure technical perspective, there's absolutely no reason at all why that wouldn't be achievable. And from what I've been reading the last couple of days, they're certainly making motions about that's what they plan to do moving forward. But as you say, there is some risk that they're going to lose agility in terms of changing the Apple Pay firmware and what it can do.
Yeah. I mean, what's your gut feeling on all of this, like with regard to which side you kind of fall on? Because I think, you know, I'm even wincing at myself asking that question because it is such a complicated little to and fro that asking people which side they're on sort of seems a bit dumb, you know? And I think the idea that it's split into two camps also is a little bit dumb. But, you know, perhaps a better question is what are your thoughts on all of this Apple versus FBI stuff?
Oh, look, it's a fascinating story, isn't it? Look, I mean, it feels to me like this is a real watershed moment in the sort of crypto wars 2.0 and the privacy debate. It's very complicated. I think it's going to end up being resolved in the courts or by Congress. And I think the FBI has been extremely clever about the way they've approached it. I think they've taken a tactical approach. So technically, they're not actually asking Apple to break encryption or provide encryption keys. They're asking them to engineer a solution that would allow them to brute force the passcode.
Yeah.
Apple's come back and said, oh, this is very, very dangerous. And if we do this, then we're creating a general weapon that once out in the world could have unintended consequences. Now, technically, I can't see any reason why Apple couldn't actually engineer a solution that is uniquely tied to that particular iPhone device.
Well, that's actually what the court order says that they can do as well,
yeah.
Right?
So I think we all agree there's no technical reason why they couldn't do that. You just hard code, you know, hardware ID into the signature so that it couldn't be generally applicable. Apple could even do the work for the FBI. You know, they could engineer this image. They could run it inside a Faraday cage if they want, inside Cupertino. You know, the FBI could be in the room next door and they could actually brute force the password themselves and then destroy that firmware if they want to. Of course.
Oh, well, look, you know, as we mentioned in the news, like, you know, it's clear that both sides here have chosen this moment. Like, it's not about this phone. Like, Apple's PR is all, you know, it's all their pre-canned PR for Crypto Wars. They just decided to sort of dust it off, take it off the shelf and use it in this instance. But I guess I'm just wondering on gut feel how you feel about this, you know, being someone who's the CTO for a technology firm.
Well, I completely support the principle that we shouldn't engineer purpose-built backdoors into encryption technology because they are.
But is that what this is? Do you think this is a backdoor
of mass destruction? Well, no, I think it's.
They're asking. They're not asking for a backdoor. They're asking for a key to the one that's already there.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and I think that that sets a dangerous precedent. And that, as you said, I think both Apple and the FBI are taking this moment in time to wage a very public battle in the public eye that will determine in large extent how easy it is for governments to enforce this in technology companies in the future. Because, I mean, from what I read, Apple asked the FBI originally to make this request under seal, under a private seal. And you wonder if they had done so, whether Apple would actually have complied quietly just for this particular case.
There's so much PR bullshit involved in this, isn't there, really?
Yeah, but the FBI decided to go public with it. You know, tactically, they've approached it very sensibly. You know, they've got the relatives of the victims involved. It was a very high-profile case, et cetera, so there's a lot of sort of public emotion involved. You know, I completely agree, you know, with Tim Cook's view that this, I think this is a wedge strategy by the FBI. You know, they're trying to set a precedent for a government to force an organization to provide access to their devices. We, you know, technically they're not providing the encryption keys, but it's definitely the slippery slope.
So, oh, it's 100% a slippery slope argument. But but anyway, look, we should talk about some other stuff because it's all been Apple this week, right? So we were chatting before this interview and you said you've spotted some interesting use cases out there in layer two crypto land. What are they?
Yeah, so we've spent a lot of time over the last few months building out some high-speed encryption capability as, you know, cloud, inevitable growth of cloud and higher bandwidth requirements rolled out globally. And some interesting use cases have come up, one of which, for example, was lapel video cameras that a lot of law enforcement agencies around the world are starting to use. So we had a particular use case recently where a particular law enforcement agency had equipped all their officers with lapel cameras. And suddenly they're generating huge volumes of HD video feed.
Hang on, are you talking about like lapel cameras, do you mean?
Yeah, lapel.
Okay,
lapel.
Sorry, you put the emphasis on the wrong syllable.
Ah.
it's because you're sitting there sweating with a fever, but anyway.
Yeah, all right. Lapel, lapel.
lapel.
Really? Seriously? Okay, whatever. Those cameras that you stick on your police uniform that stream video.
Yeah.
So there was, we've been working with a customer who has a law enforcement agency as a client who is generating huge volumes of this very sensitive video traffic from these lapel cameras that were previously not being generated at all, and they're being streamed to a central site and then archived in the cloud. And because it's obviously sensitive data, then there was a requirement to encrypt that securely in transit as we were doing so. So that was an interesting use case that required some very high capacity network encryption that I hadn't come across before.
So how does a layer two player get involved in that process?
Well, we're working with a large cloud provider who's actually providing the service to the federal agency. So we're encrypting all of the video feed as it goes into the cloud storage across some high-speed fiber optic connections. But it had to be secured at FIPS levels because of sensitive nature of it. And that's just kind of interesting because we're starting, you know, people are slowly migrating away from sort of traditional IP VPN type services into very high speed layer two connectivity.
Well, you'd need it, man. That's a lot of video, right? If every cop all of a sudden is walking around, you know, and wants to record footage of them beating up people, then, you know, that's a lot of video.
A ton of video. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, your traditional sort of IPsec stuff doesn't kind of cut it when you get a bunch above 1 gigabits per second. So they really needed some sort of higher bandwidth solutions there. So that was just an interesting use case. I think we're probably going to see more of that kind of requirement as we roll out more of these lapel.
Yeah, cool. So you just, it's in places where it's possible to get access to a fiber circuit.
Yeah. And that's increasingly common now. You know, people starting to put in 40, 100 gig ports through the fiber providers.
Well, I mean, it's one thing too, right? Like you guys are certainly on the rise. I mean, I know most recent earnings took a bit of a hit, but whatever. You know, the general trend for Senatas is up. I mean, I'd imagine a lot of that is the fact that you can just get fiber circuits everywhere now, right? And that makes your stuff a lot more useful.
Yeah, well, certainly, you know, the days of the old IP VPN being the only way an enterprise could connect over a WAN service are kind of gone, and people are favoring higher speed layer 2 type connectivity services now through service providers. So a couple of challenges with traditional crypto approaches to that. One is IPsec is great. It's very scalable. It kind of works across any transport network, but it doesn't really deliver high performance, anything above 1 gig. So it kind of bottoms out there, tops out there. And then the other problem is that as soon as you start sending data over anything other than a dark fiber, you're basically working across a telco network, and there are interdependencies between encrypted traffic and the telco core equipment that a lot of the traditional encryption protocols don't really handle very well. Things like VLAN tag transparency, support for some of the key management frame types and things can be swallowed up by the carrier in transit rather than carrying end to end.
Yeah, so they just don't like certain packets and just go, see you later. Yeah, frames, I should say.
Certain frame, exactly. Yeah. So you turn on, you know, a encryption protocol that was designed for the LAN, try and run that across the WAN, the carrier swallows it all up and says, I'm sorry, I can't deliver this.
Non-compliant, so get stuffed, exactly. Basically, yeah.
So that's sort of challenge the kind of industry is sort of working towards at the moment. There's a lot of new standards coming out in that area to get across it.
That is a cool use case, but I know that you guys have been working on for quite a while. Like last time we spoke was November last year, and you guys have been R&Ding the hell out of a 100 gigabits per second full line rate layer 2 encryption box, which will that be the fastest in the world?
There are some, it will be certainly one of the fastest. There are a couple of 100 gig layer 1 encryption solutions on the market at the moment. So those are optical type devices running over OTN, but certainly in terms of actually layer 2 Ethernet frame protocol, it will certainly be one of the fastest. Yeah, so we've been investing a ton of time and effort getting that up, and it's basically living and breathing in our lab at the moment, which is great to see.
It's alive!
It's a great job. It's breathing.
Alive!
Yeah, the LEDs are flashing. It's fantastic. So we're very excited about that. We're doing some first customer trials in sort of May, June timeframe over in the States. So
that's soon. Yeah, so when can I ring up and go, give me 100 gig of layer 2 crypto? Like, when's that happening?
Oh, well, if you rang up in June, I could get you a couple of boxes to put on your network and test it. If you want a fully FIP certified one, we're probably looking closer towards December this year, but certainly in the next 9 months.
Long lead time there. Is anyone else doing layer 2 at that speed?
There's a couple of people looking at doing MACsec at 100 gig. You know, increasingly some of the MACsec stuff is being built into the ASIC PHYs, the actual chips. But one of the problems with MACsec is that it doesn't work very well across service provider networks for some of the reasons I mentioned earlier. So we're having to make some extensions to the protocol to actually get it to work across.
So in other words, other people have got stuff that's the similar speed, but it doesn't work very well.
Well, those are your words, not mine, mate.
Okay, yes, because we're doing the whole be very polite about the competition thing, I see. Well, mate, look, I'm going to leave it there, and I'm going to let you go and sort of convulse in a sweaty ball for the next couple of days. I really hope you are feeling tip-top real soon, Julian, and thanks a lot for speaking to us through the haze of your fever. It's much, much appreciated.
No problem, Pat. Hope it was coherent. Good to speak, as always.
That was Julian Fay of Cenitas Security there. I hope you are feeling better, mate. It really doesn't sound like you're having much fun at the moment. Big thanks to Cenitas for its sponsorship of this week's show and for its support over the years. And you can check them out at cenitas.com if you wish to encrypt your layer 2s in a very fast way. And yeah, if 100 gig of layer 2 crypto, layer 2 crypto that will actually make it out the other side of the network is a requirement for you, do get in touch with those guys and gals and they will make it happen. But that is it for this week's edition of the Risky Business Podcast, the 400th. Wow, can't believe it. Over 9 years now. I will be back next week, but until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.